All right, we'll work with this. We'll work with this. Now we got it. Okay. Tada Baba. Bokatov, our first order of business is a commercial announcement. Next Wednesday, Mil Tashem, if you followed the Torah tidbits for the last few weeks, Marav and I will be spending with the OU in Eilat for a few days, which will include Wednesday. So you're invited to hear my shiurim there, Tuesday at 5 o'clock, Wednesday at 5 o'clock, and Tuesday night will be a musical as well. So you're cordially invited to that. But Phil Chernofsky will be here next Wednesday at 9 o'clock to substitute in my place. He always has very interesting, as they say in Hebrew, pikanti things to say on whatever topic you'd like to discuss. Today is a... Yeah, Fakshan.
Someone challenged me this week about Rambam's perspective, and I thought it's appropriate. Luke Shmuel is coming up.
Okay.
On Nisim.
On?
Nisim.
Nisim.
He said to me that Rambam classifies Nisim into two groups, either completely supernatural, like the Aton speaking to Bilam, and that's therefore allegorical, and then other Nisim, like Kriyat Yamsuf, are potentially possible with wind and so on, and therefore they are not allegorical. They really
is. Okay,
is that accurate?
So number one, the discussion about Rambam is the focus of today's year, the 20th of Tevet. It's Rambam's Yahrzeit.
Okay.
So even though we're studying Rambam the whole year, but today there's going to be some type of reference to the subject at hand, Rambam Sefer Mitzvot. But it's going to be a more wide-angle type of presentation about something very unique in the Rambam's thinking. In Eilat, I will be discussing miracles modern day, and certainly taking it back to the machloket between the Rambam and the Ramban, where I'll just say in a word, it's a two-way street. The Ramban saw all of natural occurrences as one big miracle, and the Rambam saw all the miracles as one big natural occurrence.
That the basis was the timing.
The timing, that's correct. The timing was the miracle. Because even Kriyat Yamsuf, which is his example, he says, we all grew up that the splitting of the Red Sea was as miraculous as they come. He says the Torah speaks of the strong winds and so on. Anybody in a laboratory situation can take a soup bowl or a pot, fill up with water, and take a high-speed fan and hold it down on the water, and you'll see your local Kriyat Yamsuf right there. Because the pressure of the wind, it's going to split the waters. And the question is, so why? So we know that there are things called regular weather conditions, and then, as they call it on Fox News, extreme weather. Right? The extreme weather desk. So in the extreme weather desk, they talk about tornadoes and earthquakes and hurricanes and whatever. These are extreme phenomena that do not happen every single day. Nevertheless, they're all anchored in natural law, and sometimes creating extreme situations. So the Rambam says that Kriyat Yamsuf was a very freakish thing, but it can be explained using natural law. So where was the miracle? So he said it was the timing. That just like just exactly when Am Yisrael got to the point that they could have used such a freakish extreme weather condition, it's exactly what had happened. And I use that to explain the Gemara that says that what did HaKadosh Baruch Hu do after He created the world? So the Kabbalists don't have a problem with that. The answer is He never stopped creating the world. HaMachadesh B'tuvo B'chol Yom Tamid Ma'aseh V'reshit. And I believe that Einstein concurred with this, that the world is constantly in an expansive mood, and that's why many astrophysicists who are interested to know how our world was created take a look several million light years away and see how it's done, because it's still being done. So that's one understanding of what HaKadosh Baruch Hu did after 6 days of creation. He just kept going in terms of the expansion of the world. The other explanation, HaMachadesh B'tuvo, is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wills the continuation of the world, and that's called Mechadesh, constantly renewing. Because if HaKadosh Baruch Hu would cease being interested that the world should continue to exist, it would, in a snap, go back to tohu vavohu. It would disintegrate instantaneously. The other explanation to what HaKadosh Baruch Hu did after creation of the world, where the Torah says, Vaychulu Hashamayim Va'aretz, and he stopped, and he rested, and it doesn't say that on the day after Shabbat, he continues doing anything. So obviously, he went into early retirement, and we call Hasava Mikso'it. He changed tracks, direction, and took on a new profession, and the profession is being a Shatran. A Shatran went into the Shidduch business, right? So, and then the Gemara says, "Ay, kasheh alav, it's so difficult, shatranut, like Kriyat Yamsuf." So, one second, it was Kriyat Yamsuf difficult for HaKadosh Baruch Hu? It was nothing for him, it was nothing, right? So, the answer is that just as Kriyat Yamsuf, it was all in the timing, so too the Shidduch, it's all in the timing. That's all, right? Right, there we go. Okay. Now, we will deal with the subject at hand. A subject that I began working on in my YU days, leading towards a master's degree at the Bernard Revel Graduate School, subsequently expanded to my doctoral dissertation at Bar-Ilan, specifically with one particular mitzvah that we're going to use as an illustration, and it's that happens to be the prohibition of wearing shatnez, which is found in Parshat Mishpatim and Parshat Ki Tetzei, but indeed, Parshat Shmot, with Moshe Rabbeinu arriving on the scene, there's much to be said about Moshe Rabbeinu and the Rambam. As it's been said, Mi Moshe ad Moshe, lo kam ke Moshe. The Rav son-in-law, Rabbi Professor Isidor Twersky, in the last article that he published before his untimely death several years ago, he wrote that the appreciation of the Rambam, Mi Moshe ad Moshe lo kam ke Moshe, from Moshe Rabbeinu to Moshe ben Maimon, there's never been anybody as great. It didn't wait 500 years, but it was said shortly after his demise, which means that the recognition of the awesome stature of the Rambam kicked in early in the game. And that was already universal. But with regard to the Yemenite Jewish community, it was already there when the Rambam was still alive. As we take note in the Nusach of Kaddish of the Yemenite community of the 12th century, V'chayechon of Yomichon, V'chayet Rabbeinu Moshe ben Maimon, that the Rambam should have the schud of seeing the day of the Geulah, Yeheshmer Rabba Bavarach, Vidgadishti, and so on. That, to just include the Rambam's name into the fabric of Kaddish already says something of what the Yemenite Jewish community held the Rambam in such a superior regard. The Rambam, I think, is a champion of intellectual honesty. There are people who express opinions, and let's even say, for argument's sake, that the opinion is well-based and thought out, but perhaps 10 years later, 20 years later, the basis of the response or the point of 20 years earlier has been shaky or even become eroded. What does the person do? There are people who the last thing in the world that they will do is to change their mind. Because it basically said, what I said 20 years earlier is nonsense. And not everybody is willing to admit that. And unfortunately, that has a lot to do with personal character. Whereas when it comes to the Rambam, he took note that already in the days of the Gemara, there are great, great Amoraim who change their mind. And changing your mind does not speak of weakness. It speaks of strength. It speaks of character, that you're willing to get up and say, I think I had it wrong, and now I think I understand it a little bit better. And the Rambam became a champion of this throughout his life, constantly revising and reworking all of his halachic material, because his mind was dynamic. It's always in motion. He's rethinking. Truth is, our Rebbe the Rav was that kind of thinker as well. And some of us sitting here have had, I know, a personal experience with asking the Rav questions where, well, he told me this, but somebody else asked seemed to be the same question, and the Rav told him something else 5 years ago. So it could be that the Rav heard technically the same question, but he knew that the person asking the question was coming from a different place and deserved a different type of response. He was a genius at that as well. But occasionally, he rethought the subject. And it wasn't like, right, I saw it in the Mishnah Berurah 20 years ago, it's the same thing. That's not the way he worked. But if he asked him a question, his mind would go back to the sugya in the Gemara and rework it and see if he'd come up with the same conclusion. Sometimes yes, sometimes not. And that's why the Rav never published Shelot u'Tshuvot, as opposed to many other poskim who committed their decisions to writing and to print. The Rav's great-grandfather, who he was named after, Rav Yosef Dober Soloveitchik, the Beit HaLevi, the Rashiv of Alojin, then become Rav of Brisk, he said, not everything that you think should be said, and not everything said should be written, not everything written should be printed, and not everything printed should be read. So, now you know why I stopped thinking. Until you get to the stage of being read already, who's going to read it? So let's look at source number one. In Rama Melchot Tshuva, this is an odd source to begin this. Al tomar she'en tshuva ele me'averot she'esh behem ma'aseh, kegon znut v'gezel v'gneva. In the seventh chapter of the Melchot Tshuva, the Rambam says, don't think for a moment that tshuva is repenting from a concrete act, a concrete transgression, avera, and you did it, now you're not going to do it. Ele kishem she'tzarich adam lashuv me'elu, kach hu tzarich l'chapes b'deot ra'ot she'yesh lo, v'lashuv min ha'kas, min ha'eva, min ha'kina, min ha'etul, min redifat ha'mamon, v'ha'kavod, u'mredifat ha'ma'achalot. The Rambam says, uki yotze behen. The Rambam says, sometimes character, traits that are bad, or inclinations that are bad, you didn't do anything, but you just have certain inclinations to certain things, you have to do tshuva from those two. And the Rambam will go on to say that tshuva from faulty character traits is much more difficult than not eating treif. A person ate non-kosher and now does tshuva, is not going to eat non-kosher any longer. Rambam thinks that's easy. But if a person is a rodef kavod, and you know, if he doesn't get a certain aliyah, like they say, if the story of the stranger who walks at the shul, and the gabbai, it's very characteristic, and it happened to be the Shabbos in Los Angeles. The first thing, Koyan Levi, so the response the guy says is, no, shishi mafter, like, you know, I'm a shishi mafter man, you know, like, such people, do tshuva from that. That's not easy. But what the Rambam basically is telling here is that he's applying what he had discussed already in the two previous chapters, Hey and Vav of the Chot Shuvah, the doctrine of free will. That you have the ability to change course in terms of your thinking and your opinions, which really forms the basis of the Rambam understanding that while there is a tradition to Torah Shebaal Peh, there's much leeway in terms of interpretation, and then certainly in terms of application, and which leads the Rambam to be intellectually honest throughout his life. There are changes that the Rambam makes very late in life, where because apparently he may have had Parkinson's, because we know the handwriting samples of the Rambam from the manuscripts, and we know that the last 3-4 years of his life, it's sloppy, and the Rambam's manuscript at age 30 is absolutely beautiful. Imamish beautiful. I mean, it's Judeo-Arabic, but there's stuff in Hebrew that's legible, very, very legible. And late in life, he just couldn't do it anymore. And he asks his son, Rabbi Avraham ben Rambam, who we also have manuscript specimens of his signature. So we know that the latest changes that the Rambam makes in his manuscripts, he asks his son to make the changes. So the Rambam does not stop making changes. And when he makes a change, he realizes, I may have talked about it in a different book as well, so let's get back to that sefer and make the change. So with regard to the Mishnah commentary, which he writes between age 23 and 30, and then the Mishnah Torah between age 35 and 45, so there are many changes that go on in that latter period in the Mishnah Torah, where he then goes back to the early work and makes those changes. But the sefer that he writes in between, the sefer that we're doing this year, Sefer Mitzvot, he sometimes comes back to it and makes the change, and sometimes just leaves it alone. We saw such an example when we did the shir on Don't Walk on Chum Shabbat, where Rambam clearly made a series of changes, but it didn't show up in the manuscripts of the Sefer HaMitzvot, because the Rambam felt this is a book that just gives me the numerical listing of the mitzvahs, just with some midrashic base of the mitzvah. He said clearly in one of his responsum, I'm not going into details here, so we don't hold him accountable in that book. But there are certain examples that even in the Sefer Mitzvot, the Rambam thought it imperative to make the change. So he's constantly making changes. And much of these changes are verifiable today in manuscript form. In the Perush HaMishnah, which are six orders of Mishnah, we have the Rambam's autograph, his own Perush HaMishnah, for the first five. Except for Seder Taharot, everything else we have Rambam. And you can see what he wrote originally, you can see what he writes in the margin, you can see what he writes between the line, and he was very, very kind that if he made a change, he didn't do what kids do on a test when they change. They take the pen and they make sure the teacher doesn't have a zecher of what the student wrote beforehand, before he makes the correction. The Rambam simply put a line through the erasure, one line, which means that what he wrote originally is still there and legible, which is very important, and that allows us today to reconstruct what the Rambam said originally as opposed to what he said afterwards, and from there you can have a whole world view as to the Rambam's approach to sources before and after these changes. And what we're going to see now is something phenomenal. Number one, in source number two, you have an example of a great Amora, the first of the Amoraim of Bavel, Rav, who changes his mind. The question there, I don't want to get into a whole detail here, but the question is with regard to Mashiach Baruch Mar Geshem, on Shmini Atzeret and Chutz Laaretz, you have 2 days Yom Tov, so Simchat Torah is also Shmini Atzeret. So there's an opinion that says that you start saying Mashiach Baruch Mar Geshem by Musaf, but then you stop by Ma'ariv. You get into Simchat Torah, you go back to summer version until tomorrow's Musaf, because Simchat Torah is really a take two. It's a redo of yesterday, of Shmini Atzeret. So how can you bench Geshem if by Shacharit you said already Mashiach Baruch Mar Geshem? So there's an opinion that it's strange to us because we don't do this. That's what you do. It says Amar Rav Matchil B'Musafim. You start saying Mashiach Baruch Mar Geshem of Shmini the Gemara begins. Vanan de Itlan Tre Yome. We in Chutz Laaretz have 2 days Yom Tov. Hecha Yavdinan. How do we carry out the halacha of Mashiach Baruch, which Shmini Atzeret, Amar Rav, Matchil B'Musafin, we begin in Musaf of Shmini Atzeret, Uposek B'Mincha Arvit V'Shachrit, and we stop saying Mashiach Baruch, B'Mincha Ma'ariv and Shachrit of the next day, which we call Simchat Torah in Chutz Laaretz, V'Chozer B'Musafin, and then by Musaf we again we do like a replay of Geshem. And then Shmuel argues with this. It just jumped 3 lines. It says, "V'chein amar Rav Sheshet kevan sheyitchil shuv eino pasek." When you begin Mashiach Baruch, you don't end it. So that's what we do. We say Mashiach Baruch on Shmini Atzeret, even a Chutz Laaretz by Musaf, and by Mincha, and by Ma'ariv, and by Shachris, and by Musaf, and by Mincha, and it just goes on until the first day of Pesach. And then it says, "V'af Rav Hadarbe." Rav changed his mind on this, and he fundamentally agrees. And that's what the Gemara really comes out, is thank God there's no machloket on this. There was a machloket, but Rav changed his mind. And Rav changing his mind, Hadar Bey Rava changed his mind, Hadar Bey Rav Ashi changed his mind. You can do a search in the Bar Ilan computer, and you're going to get numerous examples of great Amoraim that did not have a problem changing their minds. In source number 3, in Mor Nevuchim, the Rambam deals with an introductory page on what causes contradictions within a book. And he says there's 7 reasons that cause a contradiction. Sibot hastira, or hahefer, hanimsa b'sefer min hasparim, or b'chibur min hachiburim, the reason for a contradiction that may appear in any of the books or any of the writings, compositions, achat misheva sibot, is 1 of 7. And he writes the first one, Sibah Rishona, Shiyei HaMechaber Bimi Shekibetz Divrei Anashim V'lehem Deot Mitchalfot V'chasar HaBa'alim V'lo Yiches Kol Ma'amarei Le'omram. It could be that you're getting a page of opinions that really come from so many different sources. Like nobody in the world would say, "Oh, I found a contradiction in the Jerusalem Post." On one page it said this, the one page it said that. They're different writers. They're different editorial contributions. So you can't say there's a contradiction in the Jerusalem Post. You can't say a contradiction in an anthology of articles that every article is written by somebody else. But then he also talks about the fact that a person, Sibah Shnia, who Libala Sefer, who Dat, he has an opinion, Vacharken, I'm on the sixth line now, Shav Mimenu, he changes his mind, Vinichtevu Mamarav Harishon Vihasheni. And somehow the first and the second opinion might appear in the book. He says that many times you find contradictions in the Gemara, and it's either the first or the second reason. On this, Rav Kapach, in source number 4, it adds, Minasug hazeh, this type of contradiction, Hem kol hastirot hamtsuyot bedvrei Rabbeinu, is really what's behind all the contradictions in the Rambam's writings, Bein mahadurot hashonot, from the various versions or editions, Shal Pirush HaMishnah, Ubein Pirush HaMishnah leChiburo, or between Pirush HaMishnah and the Mishnah Torah, Ve'af beChibur Atzmo Ben Kitvei Yad HaShonim. From the Mishnah Torah itself, we have all kinds of contradictions. And, you know, the Rav's grandfather, Rav Chaim from Brisk, made a great name for himself, trying to locate these contradictions, and then coming up with all kinds of very, very ingenious ideas as to why the Rambam said in one place A, in the second place B, and Reb Chaim creates this lamdanut notion called Shnei Dinim, two different halachot. The Rambam over here is talking about this aspect, and in the second place talking about another aspect, and everything is dialectical, and this is the bread and butter of the Soloveitchik mind. Everything's dialectical, splitting. The Rav employs it in his philosophical discussions as well. And you come up with these great chidushim. I had a great professor at YU, some of you here remember him, Rabbi Professor Feldblum, Meir Simcha Kohen Feldblum, Zecharon Lebracha, who told us once, the more bombastic the novelty, the chidush of the Rambam that's being suggested, the less possibility the Rambam had it in mind. Because if the Rambam really wanted to have this idea in mind, he would have written it. Not wait 700 years for Rabbi Chaim from Brisk, or the Rav, you know, to bring it out. So I remember explaining once to my brother a particular famous contradiction in the Rambam, that there was a famous Rav Chaim on it. Everything's famous, you know. Because and I explained to my brother exactly what happened, and it was verifiable even in Kitvei Yad, in manuscript. And my brother tells me, he says, "You know, you might be right, but this is what you're going to say in the yeshiva in a Shir Klali. I mean, in a Shir Klali, you have to have some more schmaltz, you know, some you know, real crackerjack lomdus that's going to go along with it." Yeah, but he said, "You might be right." Well, I said, "What do you mean I might be right? It's 100% right." It's and that which was suggested as to these understandings in the Rambam, I will agree, as once discussed this with the Rav's son, Rav Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, you have to say Birkata Torah on it, because it was an act of Torah discussion. So, okay, whether the Rambam had it in mind or not is totally irrelevant. And I recall escorting the Rav back from one of his towering shiurim on the yard side of his father. By the way, today is also the Rav had the yahrzeit for his mother on the 20th of Tevet. But on the yahrzeit of his father, Gimel Shvat, he gave this 4-hour marathon shiur in front of 3,000 people. Many of the shiurim were printed in two books, Shiurim, Lesecha Abba Marizal. And I walked him back, and he said, really, towering chidushim in the Rambam as usual. And I said, "Rebbe, do you really believe that the Rambam had these ideas in mind?" And he looked at me and he says, "What's the difference? It was a good shiur." I said, "Rebbe, it was a great shiur. You know, you don't need my, you know, marks." But he said it didn't make a difference, and I was surprised because I thought he was wholeheartedly convinced that he had the, you know, the Rambam, and he was basically saying I was, you know, explaining ideas and using the Rambam as a springboard to arrive at those ideas. And the Rambam, the Rav did this all the time with Tshuva. If you read the book Ala Tshuva in any language, you see it begins with the Rambam, the laws of Tshuva, contrasts different sources, and then builds a whole pyramid of thought. In source number 5, the Rambam says, in a letter, the chola gimgum hazeh shehu megamgem alodot perush haMishnah. The modern word gimgum is stuttering. But I think what the Rambam is saying, somebody criticized the Pirush HaMishnah by saying, the Mishnah commentary, by saying, there's inconsistencies there. So the Rambam calls these critical comments, that's what he calls gimgum. So, you know, somebody was like, in Yiddish we say, machmetahan. Somebody was like trying to push it away. Rambam calls this gimgum. Blah. He was accusing the Rambam of blah, 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 blah. Right? So Rambam says, V'chol ha-gimgum hazeh, shu megamgem al odot pirush ha-mishnah, he thinks it's blah, blah, blah. Eino elo mipnei she-tikanti bo mikomot. I want you to know, I corrected places. Asher borei ha-kol yodea, Rabbeinu Shalom knows, he's my witness. Berubam bati lidei ta'ut. I, Moshe ben Maimon, arrived at these erroneous conclusions, because I was following the line of some of the Geonim who preceded him, the Geonim of Bavel, in the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th century. Kigon, Rabbeinu Nisim, Gilat Starim, Rabbeinu Chefetzal, Sefer Mitzvot, Bacherim, Sha'ani Choshesh Lahaskiram. I don't even mention their names, you know, because I have so much respect for them. But I'm telling you that I went off course because I was following blindly a particular point of view. And then when finally I opened my eyes and I realized, one second, they were off track. And that's why I made corrections. And a similar in source number 6. And this has to do with the question of Prusbul. Prusbul is an issue that we have for Shemitah, with this cancellation of loans and the Takanah, the institution of Hillel HaZaken, that one can have a bypass road of Prusbul because the Shemitah today is only the Rabbanan. So it's like selling Chametz, it's like selling for the Shemitah of the land. We have all kinds of bypass roads in the Halakha. And the questioner writes that that which is in the Perusha Mishnah is the exact opposite that he found in the Mishnah Torah. Right? Classic stira, classic contradiction. So in source number 7, you have the response, Hatshuva ma shekatavnu b'chibur hu anachon. That which I have in the Mishnah Torah, which came later, I'm now 35 to 45 years old, that's correct. So obviously he's writing this even after age 45. Asha ein bo safek. There's no doubt about this. This is correct. V'kach katavnu b'perush ha-mishnah. And I even wrote this in the Mishnah commentary. V'zeh asher b'yetchem. But the version, the copy of the Mishnah commentary that you have, he doesn't say it was a mistake. He says, "Hu anuscha rishona asher yatzah mitachet yadeinu kodem shediyaknu." It's not that there was a scribal error in writing it, and therefore you got yourself a corrupt manuscript. No, it's me. I wrote it. I admit it. But before I really was able to be precise in understanding the halacha, I wrote the wrong thing. And he admits, as I was following Hamamar Achrei Mashekatav Bal Sefer Mitzvot Harav Chefetzal, one of the Geonim, says I was following a particular halachic line. V'hu ta'ut mitzidi, it was an error on my part. Ubazesh Nimshachnu Acharav Haya Mitzideinu Chosa Iyun. I was not halachically mature enough to recognize where his view was taking me, and he wrote what he wrote. But after I became smarter and I realized, you know, how the halacha is going to proceed, the way I understand it, nitba'er ma shekatavnu b'chibur, then you will see what I wrote in the Mishnah Torah, shehu anachon, that's correct. V'taknu perush ha-mishnah, and he tells the questioner, correct your version of the perush ha-mishnah. וכן באותה הנוסחה הראשונה בפירוש המשנה ממקומות מספר כי יוצא בהם. This is not the only place this happens. This happens in other places. But this is obviously a tshuva that for whatever reason the Rambam says כמו עשר שאלות אשר נמשכנו בכל אחת מהן אחרי דעתו של גאון מן הגאונים. About 10 other places that I followed some of the גאונים. ואחר כך נתברר לנו מקומות הטעות. Well, 10 places? Well, it's a gross exaggeration. 10 places. Why did Rambam say 10 places? And I think he didn't want to scare them. Maybe Rambam didn't realize how often he does this, or this is very early in the game, in the process of the changes. The Rav son-in-law, Professor Isidor Twersky, in his monumental work that came out in 1980, Introduction to the Mishnah Torah of the Rambam, was translated into Hebrew and it was published in 1992. So that's already after my dissertation appeared at Bar Ilan University in 1987. And there, I already provide statistics on how many times the Rambam changes his mind from the Pirush HaMishnah, the Mishnah commentary, to the Mishnah Torah, and it adds up to 749 examples. Right. And Professor Rabbi Twersky even gives me credit for the legwork on this one in his book. So now if you saw the film, Ha'arot Shulayim, you know, so now I could be a candidate for Pras Yisrael because I was quoted in a footnote in Twersky. I did nothing else in life, but I was quoted in a footnote in Twersky on the statistics. Because I asked the Rav's son, Chaim Soloveitchik, you know, who grew up with Rambam with mother's milk. So I said, how many times do you think the Rambam changed his mind? He said, 60, 70 times, just as a, you know, off the cuff. So I said, Rav Chaim, you know, it's 10 times that number. He flipped. And, you know, I started providing him with all kinds of data that he wasn't, you know, he never heard of. So that this is important. So just to establish the fact that who the Rambam is, and we're going to use one example now that will illustrate at least 70 to 100 examples of these 700 of what happened. So broadly stated, what happened? The Rambam, when he was young, born in Spain, in Cordoba, Spain, and that's a conjecture whether it was 1135 or 1138. That's also a manuscript problem when he was born. But here, at the end of the Perish HaMishnah, he says, he signs off, and he says it's now, he gives a date. He doesn't say 1168, but it's equivalent to 1168, and I'm 30 years old. Okay, you don't have to be an Albert Einstein to figure this one out. That if he's born, if he's now in 1168, then I'm 30 years old. I was born in 1138. The only problem is that the Rambam's grandson, Rabbi David ben Avraham ben Rambam, who provides a letter of biographical information of his Saba, the Rambam, from him we know that the Rambam died on Kaf Tevet, which equivalent to the year 1204, which means this year is a very nice round-numbered yahrzeit today, 813 years since the Rambam passed away. We also learned that the Rambam was born on Erev Pesach, on Yud Dalet Nisan, and there he gives a date that's equivalent to 1135. That letter was the authoritative historic record of when the Rambam was born for years. In most encyclopedias, I would even say, even and to my surprise, in Rabbi Twersky's book of the Rambam, he still says on page 1, 1135. But that was changed by many great people, like my own mentor, Rav Professor Shlomo Zalman Havlin, and Rav Kapach, and Rav Yitzhak Shilat, a big Rambamist at Ma'ale Adumim, and others who recognize that what's more authoritative is not the Rambam's grandson, but the Rambam himself, and it's the end of the Perish HaMishnah. Interestingly, a great, like Rav Professor Shol Lieberman, Zecher Lebracha, who was aware of the end of the Perish HaMishnah, he said the word Vishalosh must have been erroneously not copied in. Somebody, the cipher left it out. It should be Vani ben Shloshim Vishalosh Shana, because everybody knows the Rambam was born in 1135. So if it's 1168, and now I'm 30 years old, that's not going to work. So even though it only says Vani ben Shloshim Shana, it must probably read Vani ben Shloshim Vishalosh Shana. So that's interesting how he deals with it. And he was a great Shol Lieberman, no doubt. But okay, that's small potatoes when the Rambam was born. But what the Rambam grows up in Spain, he's 13 years old, and they flee Spain. And they go to Fez, Morocco. From Fez, Morocco, there are all kinds of stations in North Africa, and he eventually makes it to Eretz Yisrael. And he's here in Eretz Yisrael for a whole 6 months. Yet he ordains a yomta for his family for generations to come to celebrate the day of his arrival, Eretz Yisrael, first time. But after a half a year, he goes back to Egypt, Alexandria, which was the port city, and then southern, more central Egypt, to what was old Cairo, was called Fostat. And that's where he lives out his life. He's 30 years old, he's already in Fostat, and till the end of his life, that's where he is. Whether he's buried in Tveria or not is conjecture. I don't want to get into that. The statistical probability that a body could have been brought over from Egypt to Eretz Yisrael for burial in the 12th century, or beginning of 13th century, was almost nil. And the Egyptian Jewish community actually have a tradition of the Rambam's kever in Fostat, in old Cairo. I think somebody would speak a little bit more authoritative about this would be Rav Chaim Sabato or any of his brother, illustrious brothers or cousins who are all from Egyptian Jewish community stock. And the word Sabato, by the way, is corruption of the word Shabtai. The family name was Shabtai. And there is a Shabtai Sabato, more than one in the family, a Rosh Hashiva, a doctor, whatever. So Rav Chaim Sabato is well known because he's a Rosh Hashiva and an author and so on. So they're from that stock. So they have a tradition where the Rambam is buried in Egypt, not in Tveria. So anyway, so the Rambam learn Gemara like anybody else who would learn Gemara when he was young. And there's a text, and you just assume that everything you're reading on the page is authoritative from the days of the Gemara. When the Rambam gets to Egypt, something very interesting happens. He gets a hold of manuscripts of the Talmud Bavli from the East. What's the East? The East is Baghdad, because that's where the Geonim were. That was Bavel. The great yeshivot of Bavel end up in Baghdad in the 9th, 10th century, 11th century. Rav Sadia Gaon, Rav Hai Gaon, his father Rav Shira Gaon, and a Gemara that is a 7th century text makes it to Egypt in the Rambam's day. So he's 12th century. And he's reporting in the Mishnah Torah, I've got manuscripts, Gevilim, that are 500 years old, which means they're 7th century texts. And lo and behold, not everything in that text is in his Gemara that he learned when he was in third grade. There are things that are just not there. And the Rambam becomes aware of a phenomena called interpolations into the text. What does that mean? There was a Talmud Bavli at the end of the Amoraim, which is the beginning of the 6th century. But then the Rabbanan Svoraim, what does the word Svoraim mean? Commentators, explain. So they wrote things. Where did they write things? They wrote them on the margin. No, they wrote things on the margin. You know why they wrote in the margin? Because cloth, parchment, was very expensive. So they wrote things on the margin. The next cipher, the next scribe, that gets a hold of a manuscript that one of the Geonim used in the yeshiva, and he's now going to copy it onto a new manuscript, thinks, erroneously, that that which is on the margin, why is it on the margin? Because the last cipher skipped a line. And now he's going to do us a big favor and include it. So what does he do? He copies the text with these annotations on the side into the corpus itself. And now it becomes difficult, you the reader, to decipher what was original material and what's later material. Now why is this important? Because the Rambam says unequivocally that only that which hits the day of Ravina and Ravashi, the end of the days of Gemara, is authoritative, which means he won't challenge Amoraim. You're not going to see a machloket, the dispute between the Rambam against the Rava and Abaya. You're not going to see that. They're not going to do that. But if it's the Geonim, the 8th century, 9th century, the Rambam himself unabashedly thought that he was greater than some of them. He says it. He had no problems because he understood that the word Gaon in the period of the Gaonim is not what we call the Vilna Goyim. Because today the word Gaon implies, you know, something super great and so on. Although Rav Avad Yosef correctly pointed out that there's inflation on the term Gaon. Because sometimes if I get mail, Harava Gaon, I'm telling you it means nothing. It means nothing. And Rav Avadya was correct that every Tom, Dick, and Harry became a Gaon today. So much so that when the Rav turned 80 in 1983, so in the Torah journal HaPardes, which is published by Agudat Israel of Borough Park, just knowing where this comes from, not exactly the biggest fans of Yeshiva University, putting it bluntly, but the editor, Rav Simcha Elberg, Zichron Lebracha, was a personal friend of the Rav and of the president of the Yeshiva, Dr. Belkin, Zichron Lebracha. So he uses his publication. I mean, that was a publication of you. Who writes there? Rabbi Shvainshi wrote, Rav Ruderman writes, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky writes, the Gedolim of the contemporary days of the 50s and 60s. So the Rav turns 80, he has an opening page called Sar HaTorah, the Master of Torah, and it's about the Rav. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece. And he writes two things. One was clear, we all knew as Talmidim. He says, he uses a takeoff on the phrase in Baba Batra, Misha Lo Ra'ah, Beit HaMikdash, Bana Hordus, Lo Ra'ah, Binyan Yafeh Miyamav. Right, whoever never saw the Beit HaMikdash that Hordus rebuilt, never saw a beautiful building in his life. So, Simcha Elberg writes, Misha Lo Shama Shi'ur, Me'arav Soloveitchik, Lo Shama Shi'ur Tov Miyamav. You never heard a shir from the Rav, you never heard a good shir in your life. That was first. But more important, he wrote, that he restored integrity to the word Gaon. That was a beautiful thing for him to say. A beautiful thing. Because he lives on a block where every Tom, Dick, and Harry is a Rav Gaon. So he wanted his followers and his readers to know that there was a term that means Gaon and it meant it, like in Gaon Mivilna. But in the days of the Geonim, it did not mean that. It comes from a pasuk in Yeshayahu, Gaon Yaakov, and as the Ramban says, Yaakov is Am Yisrael in the diaspora, in the Galut, and it meant the head of the yeshiva. So the head of the yeshiva could have been the outstanding Torah luminary, or he could have been a good administrator and a fundraiser. So without any Lashon Hara whatsoever. So at Yeshiva University, you had Dr. Revel, Dr. Belkin. I mean, they were absolutely tremendous Talmidei Chachamim. Raising money for a yeshiva. Rabbi Lamb was a sensational rabbi in Baal Machshava. And then Mr. Richard Joel, who's an administrator, okay, now they took another rav. All I'm saying is that when you take a mister, what you're basically saying is that now the head of the institution is still going to be the president, carries the same title. So the gaon of the yeshivot in Bavel, some were outstanding total luminaries, like Rav Sadia Gaon, Rav Hai Gaon, his father Rav Shira Gaon, Rav Yudai Gaon, the author of the Halachot Gedolot. Fine, but then you had other anonymous Gaonim who weren't such Gaonim in our sense. And the Rambam knew that. So therefore, he could challenge. And if the Rambam snuffed out that a line in the Gemara was not authentic Gemara, he could accept or reject. He had the option to accept or reject. And my discovery is that he rejects as well. He doesn't always reject, but he does reject. He has enough textual basis to say, this line is not Gemara. But what I am saying is that young Rambam never knew of this phenomenon. The phenomenon hit him later on in life when he comes to Egypt. And only then does this separation in the text take place. And now we get to the case. The case is Shatnez. In the bottom of the first page, from Parshat Ki Tetzei, Dvarim Kavbet, Lo Tibah Shatnez, Tzeme Upishtim Yachdav. So the Torah defines what Shatnez is. It's wool and flax or linen together. The next pasuk has to do with tzitzis. It's not an accident that tzitzis comes right after Shatnez. We'll see this towards the end. Not an accident. Just file that on the low back burner. Source number 9. So here we go. Sefer Mitzvot. Finally we arrived at our station of our shiur. V'amitzvah ha-mem gimel. In the listing of the don'ts of the lo tase, mitzvah 42, hi shehisharinu. We were warned, Milubosh Beged Arug Bitsemer Upishtim. Kiboshayulov Shim Komre Abudazara Botosman. Here the Rambam throws in a piece of Ta'amea Mitzvot. Why does the Torah prohibit the wearing of Shatnez? Because it was the fashion of the priests of the idolatrous worshippers. There's a danger in suggesting that kind of rationale. Well, today, the priests of any religion, they don't necessarily wear big day shatnas. So if the reason is no longer with us, why is the Avera still with us? That's a question that has to be answered. Of course, the response would be, there are other reasons why. And the best reason is, kachaze, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu said so. And even though, in kindergarten, what does the ganenet tell the kids? Kacha zot lo tshuva. Kacha is not an answer, but she's wrong. Because it says, Ashrei ha'am she kacha lo. Right? So kacha is a response. Kacha zot. Torah says, lo tibah shatnez. You got a problem with that? Try another religion. Right? But the Rambam sticks his neck out and says, this has to do with Avodah Zarah. Okay. And this is the danger, I say, of engaging in ta'amei ha-mitzvot. Rav Kapach points out in his edition of the Sefer Mitzvot, I'm going to read it in Hebrew first, I'll translate it. What the Rambam says, Milabosh Beged Arug Bitzemer Upishtim, Zeu Lefi Shitato, this is according to his opinion, Bitzeiruto, when he was young. Shaya Savur, She'en Kilayim de Torah, Ela Shua Tavi Venuz. Shua Taviv Venuz is three words, which if you just take those three words and you ram it together into one word, it spells out Shatnez. Spells out Shatnez. No different than what the Rambam says in Bar Nevuchim, Shem Havaya, Shem HaMefurash, Yud Kei Vav Kei, Yud Hei Vav and Hei, is nothing but three words together, Haya Hove V'yiyeh. It means eternity. And the Rambam believed that when it was properly articulated, you got the feeling of eternity as well. It projected eternity. And what the Rambam, what Rav Kapach is saying, is that the Rambam defines the Isur, the prohibition of Shatnez, that it's all interwoven together. Now the Mishnah is going to teach us that there are three processes of textile connections, of threads. One is called Shua, one is Tavi, one is Nuz. And you have to have all three in order to create a Shatnez Min HaTorah, the biblical Shatnez problem. If you only have one or two of the three, it's only going to be rabbinically prohibited. That's what the Gemara is going to say. And the Rambam, according to Rav Kapach, who says, Shehiziranu milibosh beged arug b'tzemer pishtim, without qualifying the differences and saying, well, it's got to be all three, this, that, is accepting the point of view that it, the ariga is a title. Ariga means interwoven, and it's got to be interwoven with all of the above. And the Mishnah, source number 10, says it clearly. Ein isur mishum kelayim. There's no prohibition of shatnez. Ela tavi v'arug. Shneemar lo tilbash shatnez. Davar shehu taviu shua tavi v'nuz. And those three words, sandwiched, crushed together, spell out the word, or form the word shatnez. So shatnez is a type of word where the commentators, like Ibn Ezra, you know, he's into linguistics. So what does the word shatnez mean? He says, "Ein l'se ach v'reya." There's no parallel of this word in all of Tanakh. So I don't have a clue what the word really means. How do you know what it means? If you know, how does that Ben Ezra, you know, explain words? He said, "Ah, over there, the word appears in some form, and in context, we understand what it means. So let's bring over that explanation to here, and we'll figure it out." But if it's ein ach v'reya, if there's no parallel anywhere in Tanakh, Ben Ezra doesn't have a clue how to translate the word shatnez. And the Mishnah is basically saying, there is no word shatnez. It's three words smashed together. Yeah?
So what are the three components? Interwoven and...
Right. So again, my mother-in-law was into textile. I should have asked her to get prepped for this year what the Shua Tavi V'Nuz is. So it has to do with, setting them one across the other, and then weaving one into the other, and then tying it to the other. It's a process by which you began with empty threads or loose threads, and the end product is a garment.
But it has nothing to do with, let's say, interwoven, when you get the fabric is done, and then, or maybe sometimes having a wool garment that has an interfacing like a man's suit. So
right. That's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about a piece of wool,
and then
you know, sewing on a piece of linen, which is one of the things that is done in a shatnez testing place. They're looking at the pockets. They're looking at some lining under the collar. Right. The last time I bought a suit, you see, before my parents came in Aliyah, I had the best deal in the world. When I came to visit America, I always wore a shmata, so my mother would say, "Go to Avenue J and buy a new suit." It always worked. It always worked. So I remember there was this store, very lovely store, nice Jewish lady, but she had a man, an Indian person, who was the salesperson, yes. Salesman. Yeah. And he takes out a suit and he tells me, "It's glot." Glot. And you know, I want to tell you, I didn't know what he was telling me. I heard the word glot. What was he actually telling me? So I remember, see, my Bar Mitzvah Parsha, Parshat Toldot, that's where the word glot is found. It's called chalak. You know, we saw balsar chalak. Chalak means smooth, right? So I thought he was telling me that the wool is smooth. It's chalak. I thought. No, this guy was telling me that all the suits were tested for shatnez before they were brought into the store, so I shouldn't have any problems, you know, trying it on. Does anybody have a problem trying it on before the shatnez testing? Nobody. Why? And I'll explain to you why. You'll see in a moment why. But better yet, my last suit I bought in Borough Park, because that's what my brother told me. Go to Borough Park. And did I know they first open up at 2 in the afternoon? Because in the morning they're sitting and learning. So I came at 11 at Dreza Harum Borough Park for 3 hours until they opened up at 2. You know, they were sitting and learning. Okay. But I need a suit. You know, I'm going back home. You know, to say that. So at the end, the guy tells me the shatnez tester is coming tomorrow. I said, I'm flying back to Israel tonight. So he says, I'm telling you, I haven't seen a positive testing on 20 years on Shabbos. I'm telling you it's okay. The owner of the store, said, I'm telling you it's okay. Haven't seen a positive testing. Why? It's all synthetic. It's all synthetic. Nobody's banging Shabbos anymore. Years ago, I heard that stuff coming out of Czechoslovakia and Poland, there were certain countries that had a bad track record with regard to shotness. I knew that. But American goods coming out of, you know, China, I mean, of course, now with the new president coming in, everything is going to be American-made, and nothing's coming out of China anymore. China can take their 1 billion people and wash their own shirts, and that's it. And that's it, right? So this is a textile that the Mishnah says is the biblical prohibition. Let's look at source 11. Source 11 reads, Perish HaMishnah of the Rambam, to Masechet Kilayim. This is the Rambam. Shua hu halibud, b'pnei she'machlikim et p'nei oto adavar hamilubad. It's the smoothening out. Smoothing it out. Smoothing out the everything, putting it on the table and setting it. Tirgum v'tach et habayit. There's a phrase even in Parshat Metzora. Shua, there it says, the translation is v'yashua yat beita. So that's what tiyach is. That's what it comes from. V'tavi hu she'yarav tzemer v'shishtem yachdav v'yitve me'en chutim. The weaving of one thread with the other. And nuz she'yareg mehem yachad arig. This is where you all put it all together. So it's like three stages in the production of the textile. And then I'm jumping to where it says, another just two lines, V'zeh dafke b'kelayim shel Torah. This is the biblical kelayim. She'no nikra kelayim, ela ad shiyu bo kol shloshet hadrachim eilu. Unless you have all three of this process in the picture, you don't have biblical kelayim. The cholma, and the word kilayim and shatne is interchangeable. Okay, I hope that's understood. The cholma shezulatze, anything that does not have the three stages, hareyu kilayim midevrei sofrim. It's rabbinic kilayim, not biblical. And now we start reading, continue, where it says mahadura kama. This is what the Rambam writes now in the first version. V'zeh psak nachon she'en bo safek. This is correct what I just said. V'u lashon ha-talmud. It's a gemara like that. And if you see anybody arguing with this, don't doubt it. He forgot a Gemara in Masechet Nida. Rambam says very emphatically, what I said now, based on a Gemara, and I can even tell you what Masechet it's in, because he doesn't tell us the daf, because there are no dafim yet in the 12th century. That's a printer's issue of the last 200 years. That's what the Rambam writes. So that's a psak nachon. But now, where it says madura batra, last version, the Rambam, what I just wrote on the madura kama, he erases. Erases doesn't mean erasure; it means he puts a line through it, and he rewrote the following: kein katvu k'tzat min ha-geonim. Yes, some of the geonim said that it has to have all three stages in the textile process to become shatnas doraita. V'ze etzli bilti nachon. But I believe that's not correct. Even if it just has one of the three of the processes, it's already biblical shatness. What about the Gemara Nida? The oto halashon hakatuv b'gemara maseret Nida eino lashon haTalmud ela kibush. It's an addendum. It's not Gemara, and I can disassociate myself from it. He had no problems doing that. Now, what's the Gemara? Source number 12. Masechet Nida Samach Aleph Amud Bet. Imagine I had to read 61 pages of Gemara just to get to this line. No, actually, I didn't do it that way. No. But I'm not going to give away my trade secrets. You know, called the Barlan computer. Omar Rav Acha Berei de Rav Yeba Mishmei de Marzutra. Rav Acha, the son of Rav Yeba, said in the name of Marzutra, Hai man, the person, the individual, the Rami Chuta de Kitna, that took a thread. Chut is a thread. Kutna is like wool. Beglima de Amra, in the glima, which means a shirt of some sort, some garment. And Amra is, no, Kutna is the, it actually means the linen. And Amra is the wool. Vinatke. What did he do? He has a needle, and he has a garment, and he threads, puts a thread through it. That's all. And then most probably said, one second, this is wool, this is linen, I can't do that. So he pulls it out. And guess what? It ripped. The thread is embedded now in the garment. And he can't pluck out. You know, sometimes you can't even see these small parts of the thread that got stuck in the garment. So is that garment off limits? Can you wear the garment? Yes or no? V'lo yada inatik ilonatik. I'm not sure. Did I get it all out? Did I not get it all out? Shapir dami. Yeah, you can wear the garment. You can wear. Shapir means it's fine. You can wear the garment. My timer, what's the reason? Memtet. My timer, what's the reason? V'doraita, biblically, shatnis ksiv. It says shin ayin tet nun zayin. Ach yushua tavi venuz. You have to have all three of the pasis. And here, clearly, you don't have that. You just have some type of superficial introducing the thread into the garment, but this is not shua tavi venuz. V'rabanan hu degazlu. Nevertheless, this garment would be restricted rabbinically. V'kevan de lo yada inatke, because he's not sure if he got it out or not. So the whole thing now is a safek. And what's the rule? Safek de rabbanan, the hakel. It's lenient. We're lenient because it's only a safek, a doubt in a rabbinic prohibition situation. So therefore, shari it's mutter. Matkifla Ravashi. Ravashi asks a question. One second. Amor, perhaps it's not shua tavi venuz, but o shua, o tavi, o nuz. It's either one, but not all together. So he objects. He says, why do you say it's a rabbinic issue? Maybe it's a biblical issue. And now it's safek to oraita lechumra. You have to be strict. So Gemara answers, v'hilchata dalacha is like the first opinion. Kimazutra. Why? Midafkinu rachmana b'chada lishta. Because the Torah sandwiched these three words into one word. The Shatnez is Shua Tavi Venuz. The Torah wrote it as one word to teach you it's got to be all three. Fine, that's the Gemara. This is the Gemara that the Rambam bases his early opinion. So what does the Rambam say is not authentic Gemara in his later opinion? What's underlined? The Hilchata and the law is like Marzutra, Midafkinu Rachmana Bechada Lishna. What brought the Rambam to make the change? Because it contradicted a very interesting halacha in tzitzit. Tzitzit, you're allowed to make tzitzis where the garment is linen and the wool and the tzitzis are wool. So it could be shatnez. Yes, yes. You're allowed to wear it. Because asei docha lo tasei, a positive will dodge away, they will block away the negative. So that's very interesting, says the Rambam. What do I mean that the tzitzis and the garment which is linen, is that shua tavi venuz? What you do is you simply insert into the hole in each corner the four strings, and then you start tying them. That's a pretty superficial type of connection to the garment. That's not weaving it into the garment at all. There's no linen in the wool, and there's no wool in the linen. And yet the Torah saw fit that HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe Rabbeinu no fewer than 10 times certain mitzvot b'dibur echad, in one breath, to teach us halachot. The famous being Zachor v'Shamor with Shabbat, with Kiddush. Zachor yom Shabbat HaKadosho, Shamor yom Shabbat HaKadosho, Zachor v'Shamor b'dibur echad, we say it in Lechadodi. That's to teach us that just as a woman is obligated in Shmirat Shabbat, in terms of the Melachot, she's obligated also in the positive mitzvah of Zachor, which is Kiddush, because you might assume that it's a time-bound mitzvah, mitzvah taseh shazman grama, and women would be exempt from Kiddush. No, women are obligated in Kiddush because Kadosh Baruch Hu said Zachor and Shamor b'dibur echad, in one saying. Here comes a saying, announcement. Yeah, let's see. What? It's for me. Okay.
Is that Bezer?
Yeah, Bezer. Thank you. Thank you very much. So one of the examples is Lotil Bashatnez, Gidilim Tasalacha. That's why in the last source of the first page I brought both psukim. Lotil Bashatnez, Senru Pishtim Yachtav, Gidilim Tasalacha. Make tzitzis. Why did the Torah give the mitzvah of tzitzit right next to the prohibition of Shatnez? to teach you that if the tzitzit is going to be of shatness, you can wear those tzitzit. Asei dochal lo tasei. So the Rambam says, that's not shua tavivanus. Would a Kadosh Baruch Hu teach Moshe Rabbeinu a special halakha to permit a rabbinic add-on? That's ridiculous. So it's got to be a biblical prohibition. If I wouldn't have the mitzvah of tzitzis, just loosely tying wool to a linen garment would constitute a biblical transgression of shatness. But in the context of the mitzvah of tzitzit, it's okay. So that, we understand, that Rambam says, is a proof that it's not shua tavi venuz, that has to be this complex process of integrating the thread and the garment. It does not have to be. Even if it's loosely connected, it's also a biblical issue. And that's why the Rambam makes a change. But what allows him to make the change in terms of contradicting a Gemara is that he now has basis to say that the conclusion of the Gemara was not really Gemara. Was not Gemara. It was a late entry, a Vehilchata, which, by the way, the Vehilchata in Talmud Bavli is already becoming more and more known phenomena. There was a Rav Binyamin Menashe Levin who lived in Haifa, talking about now the 1930s. He published a series of Sfarim called Otsar HaGeonim, and he published 1935, the year Rav Kook died. They put out a very nice four-volume Sefer HaYovel, a jubilee in honor of Rav Kook. So he wrote a book, Rabbanan Sfaraim V'Talmudan, this Rav Binyamin Menashe Levin, and it has a whole chapter just on Vehilchata, where the Gemara seems to say, and the halakha is, and he shows that many of them are add-ons from the period of the Rabbanan Sforaim and the Gemara, and the Gonim. And apparently the Rambam caught wind of this only after he arrives in Egypt. Because before he arrives in Egypt, he thinks like every yeshiva bacha today, everything that you're looking at is clear Gemara. And it turns out it's really not the case. And this is just one of many, many examples which shows that the Rambam was very, very involved in manuscript study. Just to end this, the Chazon Ish, and I heard this once from Rav Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rav's son, the Chazon Ish wrote a letter criticizing the publication of the Munich manuscript of Talmud Bavli. It's the oldest full shas that we have in manuscript form from the 13th century. And it was published through a series of books called Dikduke Sofrim in the late 19th century. It had the Haskama of Gedolei Yisrael. Perhaps somebody would remember the name, Rav Shlomo Kluger. It was a known Gadol. He gave a Haskama to this Mif'al. And it was completed here in Eretz Yisrael with other people. And Rav Zevin from the Encyclopedia Talmudit gave his Haskama, his approval, approbation to this. Chazon Ish was against this whole thing, and he claimed that which was found in the Geniza should be returned to the Geniza, because if it was the will of God, he's, as providence, as Hashgacha, that the Talmud Bavli, as it came through the Vilna Shas print, this is Torah Shebaal Peh, so this is the authoritative Torah Shebaal Peh. This was God's will. And Chaim Soloveitchik responded, and I guess it was also God's will that we discovered the Cairo Geniza. He said, if you want to talk about Hashgacha, so that's also Hashgacha. Why is that not less Hashgacha? It was a very valid point. Because Rav Chaim taught us much about how to read a manuscript and how to deal with it. In yeshivas, they're pretty nervous. Let's just say nervous to deal with this, because they're not skilled. You have to learn, like any other science, you have to learn how to use manuscripts properly and effectively. And in yeshivot, they'd rather not do that. And certainly hiding behind the letter of the Chazon Ish, they're in good company there, and that's the way they'd rather do business. And they prefer dealing with problematic Rambams by suggesting all kinds of highfalutin intellectual ideas, which is all very nice and dandy. But if you want to get down to what the Rambam really had in mind, then you have no choice today but to do it not only through the conceptual route, but also through the textual route. And the combination of the two really reproduces Torah Emet. And I think if we said about Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe Emet v'Torato Emet, I think the least we can do with the Rambam is strive to the best of our ability, to Moshe Emet, the Torah Emet. All right, so next week, Wednesday, as I said, Phil Kronowski will give the shiur in my place, and in 2 weeks, Mr. Sharon will be back.
Wait, I gotta go. How do you know?